This is Nick DeOlias, and this is also the Far Middle Podcast, episode 17. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick DeOlias. Also, click on the website when you get a chance, nickdeolias.com, for some new content and updated content as time progresses. You're welcome to do so. This episode of the Far Middle is a heavy one, and we're going to stick to the theme we brought up in the prior episode of Connections and the great James Burke, the series Connections on BBC, and how we're going to try to take a handful of what appear to be at least first blush individual dots and then connect them and show how they're related. The dots we're going to select for this episode of the Far Middle is first and foremost the Afghanistan debacle and what's going on with respect to it. We're then going to connect that to the dot of elites and the types of doors that they acquire and buy and the doors that they install in their dwellings, in their homes. Interestingly, I think you'll find those two dots connected. We're then going to connect that to a third dot, which is the culture wars, specifically who won the culture wars. And then we'll wrap with a fourth dot that we'll connect this discussion to, which is the subject of pride, particularly pride in being an American. So that's what we'll discuss in episode 17 of The Far Middle. Starting with Afghanistan, which of course is by far the most serious and timely of the four. First, I want to just acknowledge, like everyone, the 13 men and women that we lost in the line of duty with what happened over the past week or so in Kabul and Afghanistan. You listen to the individual stories when you hear these family members that are on the news and on the internet talking about their loved ones that they lost. Don't they epitomize the best and the greatest things that you think of when you think of young people and you think of Americans and you think of service? Just the epitome of greatness, and to see that loss, even though you're not directly tied or related or friends with those individuals, you can just feel the sorrow and the grief of those that are, and your heart just goes out to them. Second thing I want to point out at the beginning, when talking about Afghanistan and what's going on there, this is not a partisan issue, at least from my perspective. It's not a Democrat versus Republican thing. This isn't a liberal versus conservative debate or matter either. This is an American thing, and what's going on here are issues and circumstances that are significantly affecting, in a bad way, what it means to be an American and America. And that is something that should concern all of us, no matter what your philosophical, political leanings are, liberal, conservative, or what your party affiliation might be, Democrat, Republican, Independent, whatever the case might be. And I think, too, you know, looking at this from a broader perspective, there's not a lot of disagreement out there when you get to the issue of exit. Everyone, or most individuals that thought this through, will support the concept of exiting Afghanistan. There's a number of reasons why it's time to exit. One, bin Laden is dead. So justice was served when you look at the original justification of why we entered Afghanistan to begin with, coming off of 9/11. Two, I think geopolitically, or at least geopolitical point number one, the shale revolution with natural gas and what it has done in terms of providing energy independence for the United States and for the Western democracies, and by converse, has reduced dependency and importance of areas or regions of the world like the Middle East. The geopolitical importance of Afghanistan has been diminished over the past 20 years. And then geopolitical point number two, when you look at what has been diminished with respect to Middle East and dependency on energy because of our own energy independence that we've created through innovation and ingenuity, there's also been, of course, over the past 20 years, a heightened sense of urgency elsewhere on the geopolitical map, particularly with Asia and China and the Chinese Communist Party. So there have been other priorities that have risen up in terms of importance, and in the same time and over the past 20 years, areas like the Middle East have become less important to us geopolitically because of the things that we've created for ourselves. So exiting Afghanistan, the logical, the rational call, little question about that from my perspective. But how you exit, how you do that, it matters tremendously. Everyone knows that. And I think what we've seen happen here over the past 60 days is that you took a situation regarding exiting Afghanistan from a ready, aim, fire, as you normally would execute a plan, into one of ready, fire, aim. And the turning around of the priorities and the sequencing of this really has cost us dearly. And it's cost us in blood. It's cost us in credibility. It's cost us in the here and now. And it's going to cost us into the future. So looking at that sequentially, how would you go about an exit? It's pretty straightforward. Get the people out first. So get the innocents, the American citizens, the Afghan allies, get them out first. Get the equipment out second, the arms, the ammunition, the Black Hawk helicopters, get those out second. Shut down your facilities in an orderly fashion, like Bagram Air Base. Do that at the right time. Don't do that first before you get these other things accomplished and completed. And then the last thing that you do, exit the military with the last soldier carrying out the flag folded up last. It's pretty basic, pretty straightforward. That's not what happened when you look at the past 60 days. And the administration's inability to do this in a sequential, logical fashion, the incompetence, frankly, that's been displayed, it again has cost us dearly in both blood and in credibility. There's, I think, little question on those two points. You're starting to see, I fear, the consequences of the 2020 election. They're starting to manifest. We've got 3+ more years of this. I start to worry about how much worse it's going to get. I'm very concerned watching this, again, from the perspective of being an American. In many ways, it's a bit sickening. And you get the definite takeaway or feeling that this administration, and it could be President Biden, it could be Vice President Harris, it could be the wider team of the advisors, the cabinet, and the extended advisors around the president and vice president, they've become obsessed, almost just singularly focused on optics and the politics of a situation. And they're not thinking about, they're ignoring the reality, almost to the point where they become irrevocably entrenched in their positions. Afghanistan is the most painful example of this, the most recent example of it, where they just become more and more entrenched and sticking to sound bites, sticking to optics versus the reality of what's going on. But you've seen it elsewhere too. We've seen this in the arena of COVID and how you manage pandemic. So right now, the optics, the politics, the soundbite, it's all about the masks. And again, I'm not an anti-masker. I will wear a mask when instructed to do so. I will wear a mask where it will help, you know, reduce the incidence of acquiring COVID or of transmitting it to a loved one. But these masks, the mandates, the draconian shutdowns before that that we saw earlier, comparing those approaches, which from an optics perspective sends a powerful message and from a politics perspective might be fortuitous, right? But you become entrenched with those versus something that would be, say, a more surgical approach to protections and protecting the vulnerable. It's another similar example of how Afghanistan mirrors that, how we've managed that the past 60 days. We saw it with energy policy, climate change, the Paris Accord, the zero carbon belief bordering on a religion, where physics and chemistry, math, they sort of get pushed aside, but the beliefs are elevated because they provide great optics. They are maybe politically fortuitous at certain periods of time, and they create this entrenched view on things where, again, it begins to feel a lot like more of a religion or a belief-based system rather than a surgical approach that is taking into account the math, physics, and science. So whether it's climate and energy, whether it's COVID and pandemic, you see the similarities. And I guess when we get to Afghanistan and the high stakes that are involved there, it's not surprising to see a similar approach that the administration has taken with respect to how the United States has managed it compared to those other examples. July and August of 2021, those 60-ish days or so, have not been kind to American credibility, American reputation, and frankly, the way that most people are now viewing President Biden and the current administration. you go back to early July, and you can see these different compare and contrasts of optics and politics and sound bites versus reality, what's actually happening. Go back to early July, I think it was July 8th, and the president was in a news conference and interacting with the press and the media. And the question came up from a reporter to him, did he see any parallels between the withdrawal going on in Afghanistan that was being planned and what actually happened in Vietnam in the early 70s in Saigon? And the president's response to that, and this is a quote, none whatsoever, zero, end quote. Then he followed up with that with another quote that came back to haunt him when he said the likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely. So I'm quoting from him about his view in early July, what would occur with Afghanistan, the Taliban, who assumes power, and timing. August 15th, Kabul falls to the Taliban. So the politics, the optics, the sound bites on July 8th from the president, painting a very clear picture of how things are going to go. Middle of August, August 15, complete 180 opposite when it comes to the reality of what actually occurred. Then a week or two after the fall of Kabul, on the 26th of August, the deadly day occurs when those 13 American men and women lost their lives in the line of duty. 11 of the 13, I believe, were Marines. That resonates with me in particular. We've got family who were Marines. And over 100 Afghan civilians killed as well in the attacks. What were the optics? What you were hearing was, we've got this orderly exit up until literally the day of the attack, this very orderly exit. Everyone who wants to get out of Afghanistan is going to be able to get out of Afghanistan, whether they are Americans, whether they are Afghans holding certain visas, translators, those that worked with us through the past 20 years, et cetera, et cetera. What was the reality? Taliban was providing the security around the airport, and there was mayhem all over the place. And that mayhem ensued until the attacks, and then outright panic, of course, was ensuing leading up to the attacks, and then obviously after the attacks. A 180-degree stark contrast between the optics that were being painted and that we wanted to believe and the reality that we were having to contend with, or those were having to contend with that were actually there living in it. Now, on the day of the attacks at the airport in Kabul, you also had the infamous now press conference that the president held. And I had a chance to view that one live when it occurred. I thought it looked bad. I thought it sounded bad, from my perspective at least. And the two words that I would use to summarize how I thought the president came across, one would be beaten, and the second one would be spent. Spent physically, spent mentally, spent emotionally. He just looked spent. He looked beaten. Those are not two words you want to hear when you're describing the president of the United States, and not just the president, but in the year 2021 with all the challenges that we're dealing with, and less than a year into his first term. That will set you off for some troublesome thoughts, to say the least. So the optics of the press conference, I think the things that clearly the speechwriters and the president, administration, the press secretary were shooting for, they're aiming for, one was empathy, having empathy for those that were murdered in the attacks, of course, and two, a tough stance, one that that was equated to the harsh threats for the terrorists, for the murderers, right, when he was talking about that. So those were the optics and the image that that was targeted. But I got to tell you, again, looking and watching and viewing that press conference, the takeaways I had were very different than empathy and sort of a tough stance with the terrorists. The first takeaway I had was I became a little uncomfortable, and I don't know if others did as well, but I was somewhat uncomfortable when the president was equating his son's unfortunate death, an untimely death through cancer, and what happened to the servicemen and women that were murdered in Afghanistan on August 26th. I don't view those as being the same. One, yes, they were both, of course, deaths, but one was unavoidable, health related, of course, when it comes to Beau Biden and what happened to him. The other deaths of the servicemen and women, I view as something that were avoidable. And they were, in many ways, the consequences of poor planning, of poor leadership. And those are very different situations. And the president sort of drawing parallels between the two, I know what he's trying to do. I get that. But I just think it didn't come across in a good way from my perspective. It made me cringe a bit because I just felt that those were not the same things and not the time to draw those parallels, as unfortunate as his son's death was. The second takeaway, and this is probably one that that I immediately noticed first and foremost, was when he was done with his prepared remarks, he then, like you usually do, take questions from the press pool. And you heard that that comment he made when he said he was instructed to take the first question from whichever reporter it was. He said that live. And people were criticizing him because they viewed it as one of an issue of who's in charge. Who's telling the president what to do? If someone's telling the president what to do, is this nothing more than a puppet that's being propped up to say what he's told to say? And who's the real decision makers? Who's the real power brokers when it comes to the White House and the executive branch of our government? Yeah, that's a good question. That's something, I guess, that would be a concern. But my bigger concern was not that. My concern when I first heard that was one of collusion. I thought, and I interpreted that comment that he made, that I've been instructed to call on first this individual, was basically an airing, a daylighting of an issue of collusion where the press, the media, journalists were working with the administration. They were collaborating with them. Okay, we're going to have a press conference on what happened in Afghanistan today. Here's a question that I can ask. This is all done ahead of time from the press conference. It's submitted to the administration. The administration gets it, sees the question. They prepare an answer, prep the president before the press conference on the answer. And everybody knows going into the press conference that everything's going to be staged. He's going to make his prepared remarks. The first person called on is going to be you. Here's the question you're going to ask. Here's the answer that the president is now going to scripted on and prepped on that he's going to reply with. It's not the way that journalism and the role of the media as sort of the protector of transparency and truth and checking power when it comes to government is supposed to operate. So my fear when I heard that and saw that was that it's another example that was sort of outed accidentally of the media working with government to basically plant questions ahead of time, prep the president, make him seem more in control. That is a unvirtuous circle when you look at, again, what the historic view of what media journalism and free speech is supposed to be doing versus government. And then the final sort of takeaway, the third one from that press conference on the 26th of August, and this is one that everybody's picked up on, just the president slumped over and clutching his binder toward the end of that during the question and answer session with the press. This goes back to my descriptors of beaten and spent. He just looked like a tired individual. And just like someone who the last place in the world he wanted to be was standing on that podium, he wanted all this to go away. And when you're in positions of leadership, of course, problems don't go away. You got to run to them, not hope that they go away or run away from them. So press conference on the 26th gave me a lot of concern as an American. Again, I'm not trying to be partisan about this. Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter who's up there. Once they're elected, they're the leader. And it's not a liberal, conservative thing. This is an American thing. I think we've got a problem, Americans. And what that means over the next 3+ years, I'm not exactly sure just yet. And then after the press conference on the 26th of August, the missteps just kept coming. Vice President Harris, during all this, I don't know where she's at. She sort of has disappeared. She's increasingly, to me, appearing to be more about optics and fluff. I did see certain media video segments where she was coming off the tarmac on her trip to Asia, and the reporter started asking her questions, I guess, about Afghanistan, and she was laughing them off initially. This is not the time for laughter, I would think. I think she gave a speech where she was saber rattling. I'm not sure if those sabers are of metal or plastic anymore, when it came to China. I guess China is going to become a fortuitous or convenient entity to beat upon, to distract. And I saw her at the Senator McCain Memorial in Vietnam. But again, the optics and the photo ops and the video segments and the appearances of the superficial versus where's our leadership, getting back to the United States to sort of, you know, get in the wheelhouse when decisions have to be made on the fly during a crisis. The dignified transfer ceremony, I think it was in Delaware, Dover Air Force Base with the president, that was another massive misstep. Once again, optics of, as you would expect, you know, stern-faced, the black suit, the mask wearing, of course, right? But then once you sort of peeled away that thin veneer of the optics, him checking his watch as if he's bored by this or he wants to get on to the next thing, whatever the next thing might be that's more important than a dignified transfer ceremony, not a good look for this administration. And then the other thing that I think over those couple of days after the attack that kept coming out from the president and the administration that just didn't make sense to me was this blaming this entire fiasco with Afghanistan over the past couple of months and blaming it on the deal that the Taliban struck with the prior administration and how we were bound by that. And this is just the manifestations of that prior bad deal. So the optics are, hey, I inherited this mess. That's what President Biden is saying from my predecessor, and there's nothing you can really do about that. But I think the reality is quite different, right? There's two points of reality. One, the Taliban didn't sense weakness and inconsistency until the current administration came into power. So I think they picked up quickly that there was a change when it came to strength and weakness, and they were willing to take advantage of that, and they did, pursuing their self-interest is non-democratic and as sick as it is. The second piece of reality is that you look at everything else that the prior administration had done, from executive orders to regulations to accords and agreements with other nations, individual states, et cetera. The current administration never hesitated to reverse, squash, ignore those prior policies and commitments, again, domestically, internationally, regulatorily, didn't matter. But on this one, for some reason, when it came to this one and this one only, this is one that we were bound to. We couldn't change it. We were stuck with it. That's incredibly inconsistent over what the rhetoric has been. So that didn't make sense either. And then at the end of August, around the 30th, the last soldier, the last plane exits Afghanistan. You compare that, contrast it to early August when the president was being interviewed. I think it was George Stephanopoulos that was interviewing him. And the president said, you know, if there's American citizens left, we're going to stay to get them all out. That was his quote. That was on early August. And August 30th, we were out. But there were still, unfortunately, Americans in Afghanistan. So you had basically two promises here from the administration's perspective. One promise was to not exit the country until all the Americans were out. That was the promise that he made specifically to George Stephanopoulos, but he said it and the administration said it a number of times. The second promise was one that the administration made to the Taliban, which was to exit the country by the end of August 2021. Which one of those two promises were more important? Which promise was kept and which promise was broken? That is very disturbing. Now, I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better for the United States. And if it gets worse for the United States, that means de facto, it's going to get worse for the world because of what we mean on the global stage. And why do I believe that? Well, I think Afghanistan and this debacle really highlighted a number of failings. You know, failings when it comes to the media. The media is not fact-checking government, fact-checking the administration, fact-checking the president. Again, if anything, it appears coming off that press conference that they're colluding with, collaborating with the administration and government. That's not the media's role. The bureaucrats, where are all the bureaucrats, the whistleblowers that are standing up and calling out these inconsistencies, these irrational decisions, these positions that are hurting our interests and our citizens? Where are they at? We saw them in the prior administration, but apparently their whistles have been taken away or they've lost them. Where is academia and the people in academia that set and establish policy edicts when it comes to human rights and what's going on now in Afghanistan when it comes to individual rights, when it comes to the rights of females and women. Where's academia in all of this? Well, you don't hear from any of those stakeholders because the stakeholders have lost their moral compass and their ethical compass when it comes to the reasons in large part for their being and for their existing. And the second reason that I'm really worried about this, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, is that our adversaries, China, Iran, North Korea, which I saw may have restarted their nuclear program here over the past day or two, Russia, all four of them, they view weakness as an opportunity. They know weakness when they see it. And you can't think, but they're going to come away looking at the past 60 days and how we've approached Afghanistan, which is seeing a very target-rich opportunity on their game board to take advantage of what is an inconsistent and in many ways incompetent administration. So let's jump from this, you know, really heavy, serious topic of this debacle in Afghanistan, and let's jump to our second dot, which is tied to the first one when it comes to the elite and what they say and how they appear, right? The optics versus the reality that we just covered in detail. It's always an issue. It's always rearing its head. You couple that with how government rules, regulations, statutes, policies, they say they're there to address one thing, but they're really there for quite a different reason. They're there to help an entirely different thing. Now, there's so many examples of this, how this government policy and regulations and then the elites and the optics versus reality, how they all come together. We got examples of this popping up every day, every week across the country and across the world. And there's so many of them that I'm going to have to maybe make this a weekly installment on the Far Middle podcast and maybe even dedicate a page on the website, nickdeolius.com, to address it. It really is fascinating if you start looking for it. But the one particular example I want to talk about today is a pretty cool one and an interesting one. And this goes back to New York City's Chelsea Hotel, the infamous Chelsea Hotel through the years. And I guess, it was going through a renovation, but when it was going through the renovation, it was tearing down the doors of many of these rooms in the hotel and going to replace them with newer doors. Now, the prior residents of the Chelsea Hotel were who's who of entertainment and the Illuminati, right, of celebrity. You had Bob Dylan and Tom Wolfe and Dee Dee Ramone and Jerry Garcia and Andy Warhol and on they go. But what they were doing, some of these individuals became very famous for extended stays at the Chelsea Hotel. So certain rooms became designated as so-and-so's room. This was Bob Dylan's room where he did whatever or wrote whatever. This is Jerry Garcia's room where he wrote the following song. So these doors became famous, but they were going to be replaced with new doors. And what happened was there was this renovation occurring. They chucked all these old doors into a dumpster in New York City. There was a homeless person, a homeless guy who saw this. He pulls the doors from the trash. And then he contacts an auction house, and the auction house does what they do. They auctioned them off with some of the proceeds or all the proceeds, I'm not sure how much, going to a shelter, which, feel good type of a thing. So I like quirky collectibles like this. And I saw this story and I saw the backstories of the individuals that bought these different doors of famous celebrities that had stayed in those rooms. And then they put them in their homes and displayed them in their homes. But I thought that it really provided a great example of how elites, coastal elites in particular, how they contrast to what we consider, I consider to be normal people in this country. So there's three examples there of these buyers, these purchasers of these doors that it really highlight what I'm talking about. So there's one guy, very successful, well-known, had a successful career in finance, doing some really interesting things on the philanthropic front. But he paid over $400,000 for a whole series of these doors. I think he bought over 20 of them from the Chelsea Hotel. And he has them now displayed at different spots and places within his place in Boston, which is this massive triplex, 10,000 plus square feet, 9 balconies, a dozen bathrooms, a palatial estate, to say the least. So that's one buyer. Another purchaser that I read about was a producer in entertainment in New York City. So someone that's in the arts, paid about $5,000 for a door that I think was attributed to Jerry Garcia, the room that he stayed in the Chelsea Hotel, and basically bought it as a present for a loved one. And they put it in their home, which was in the Upper West Side of Manhattan in New York. And then another purchaser or set of pair of purchasers was a pair of New York attorneys, husband-wife team. They bought, I think, two doors. They wanted to do barn doors in their suburban home in Connecticut or somewhere around New York City. So those were just examples of the type of purchasers. And I don't begrudge any of them. And I certainly don't begrudge financial success, more power to them, creating value and keeping the value they create. That's what makes America great, and free enterprise and the free market and capitalism and all those awesome things. So I celebrate it. That's not the issue. And people should be free to invest and buy what they choose. That's not the issue. Heck, if I would have known about this auction ahead of time, I might have taken a run at one or two of those doors if I had a shot at them. So what is the issue then? And for a while, it was sort of tough for me to put my finger on it. You know, unlike sort of the President Biden press conference on the attacks in Afghanistan, where it was instantly apparent what I didn't like about it or what troubled me about it. Here, I knew something was there that I didn't sit well with me, but I couldn't immediately put my finger on it. I was thinking about this over the course of days and weeks in terms of what it was in particular. And then I finally, you know, traversed my way through the root cause of what was, you know, not sitting well with me when it came to these issues of the doors from the Chelsea Hotel being auctioned and the buyers and how they ended up where they did and what they went for. And the issue is that there's a sequencing of these policies and regulations and rules that you see across now the United States and who they benefit and who they penalize, who it comes at the expense of, who it goes to the benefit for. So what you saw were purchasers in this instance who were making lots of money in certain professions, legal profession, finance, entertainment, right? How many of those professions are directly or indirectly taking subsidy or taxing other endeavors? Just about all of them. We've talked about this on prior podcasts of the Far Middle. We've talked about how the legal profession has largely become an entity that feeds off of complexity and rules that are set up where you have to go through attorneys and litigation and fighting is the key, not the outcome, because in the end, no matter who wins in the outcome, the attorneys are always going to be winners. We talked about finance and how many rules and systems and markets are set up to provide a middleman, almost an exclusive monopoly, to skim off the top of transactions that normally wouldn't require a person in the middle or an entity in the middle. And in entertainment, when you look at tax policy and how it's structured and set up and government stimulus and COVID relief packages, one of the biggest beneficiaries of all those things are always the arts and entertainment. So that was one issue that sort of stuck at me, where many of these purchasers were working in professions. They made their money, they made their living in professions that, not to their fault, but nevertheless, the reality of it is much of what drove the growth in those professions and the ability to earn a living were just conscious schemes, rules, regulations to take value from one bucket of activity within the economy and redistribute it to another, the one that they were working in. Second thing is that most of these purchasers were concentrated in the wealthy enclaves of the coast, particularly the East Coast, Boston, the Upper West Side, Manhattan, suburban Connecticut, et cetera. Think about how much of our tax policy and government stimulus is aimed to siphon money. We've talked about this again in prior podcasts, from flyover areas of the country, from the middle classes to the coasts and to the elites or the wealthy. Quite a bit of it. And then the third thing was the prices that were paid for these doors and would effectively have become collectibles. Fed monetary policy, which we've discussed at length, it creates these types of asset bubbles. While what happens with free money and the Fed monetary policy, the working poor, the middle class, they're going to struggle because of things like inflation that are stoked and higher asset prices for just about everything that you'd want to acquire or consume, from cars to homes to food. So free money, you know, it helps the door value and the door buyer when it comes to the Chelsea Hotel doors, but it's hurting everyone else. So that was the culmination of what was really the root causes of why I read that and thought about it and said, boy, this is something I should want to like, but for some reason I can't get there. Why is that? It's those three things. It's the industries that these individuals were working in and how they basically are getting their value and procuring their value from others, where geographically they resided, these coastal enclaves, and how monetary policy basically creates these asset bubbles, pumping up the value of the doors and frankly, the net worth of the individuals buying the doors, because they can afford to take advantage of free money policies, position themselves accordingly, while the mom and pop savers and the middle class and the working poor are getting pummeled by the Fed policy and free money. Which now the Chelsea doors and that whole issue brings me to the third dot of this podcast. And that is how the cultural wars in the United States of America have been won by the elites. Irving Kristol, he was an interesting guy. I don't know if you're familiar with Irving Kristol, but he's been dubbed the godfather of neoconservatism. And I don't agree with all the views that he put out there, but he did say something in the mid-90s that I thought was really timely today. He said at one point, the culture war is over, we lost. That was Irving Kristol's sort of quote. Now, if Kristol thought his side lost in the mid-90s, imagine what he would think today. What he viewed as a loss back then would go to a crushing loss or a crushing defeat, I suppose, today. And how did these wealthy, white-collar, East Coast, urbanite purchasers of those Chelsea doors, how did they win the cultural wars? There's a lot of reasons, and we discuss them extensively on the Far Middle, nickdeolias.com. We discuss it in my book, The Leech. But a big reason, a big contributor, has been academia. Academia, and specifically humanities, the social sciences, the administrative bureaucracy of colleges, wide swaths of the faculty, they've been minting drones that we call graduates, who've been injected with and now mimic leftist ideology to the point where it's just innate. It's just wired within their DNA. Academia doesn't follow the leader. It is the leader along with government. Academia created many of the left's doctrines and movements. And today, I feel as if academia has become a sanctioned cult of religion. And it's the religion, unfortunately, of the left. Now, if you bow down and you join in, when you graduate, you're going to enjoy the spoils of this cultural victory. So most of those who feed at the trough and enjoy these fruits don't even know they're doing it. So it's not something that's even consciously being done by most of the beneficiaries of what's going on here when it comes to academia and what it's minting and the ideology of the left. But they're doing so nevertheless at the expense of and on the backs of the middle class and the working poor and the flyover country, what I call the real economy, and also I'll throw in there the suburbs and rural areas of the country. It's almost become and feels like a giant cycle of value appropriation and redistribution. There's those who are creating value, they're having it taken away from them, and then it's being sent to those who are the fortunates because they've ascribed and become part of the cult or the religion. Now, the buyers of those Chelsea hotel doors, they are college educated, probably or maybe likely elite colleges. They can work at home or on the couch. Their jobs are justified on regulations or processes that demand middlemen and intermediaries to be used, and all have built up via the system net worth that probably builds upon itself with monetary policy that thinks free money is actually free and drives asset bubbles to be exploited. I think that the purchasers really weren't the ones who bought those doors. I think the taxpayers, really, when you do the math and you trace things back, the taxpayers of the United States are the ones who bought those Chelsea hotel doors. The mom and pop investor bought those doors, and the worker on the factory floor bought those doors. Their value, it just slid from them individually to the purchasers through these conduits of the Fed and the laws and the lawsuits and the regulations and the transaction fees that we're all increasingly being burdened with. And these people, these fortunate products of academia and big government and litigation and financial complexity, they're enjoying more than just neat collectible doors from old hotels. And we'll discuss more of these examples in future podcasts, but this goes way beyond the ability and the means to purchase a neat collectible to put in your home at a pretty exorbitant price, but you're able to do so because you can afford it. It goes way beyond that. And that dot of cultural wars and who won it and academia playing a crucial role in that victory brings me to the fourth and final dot for episode 17 of the Far Middle podcast. And that is academia serving as church of the left. It makes a difference on the young, and the young end up leading the country, of course, and driving the economy. The best example of this that I saw recently was a recent poll. And the poll was basically asking a whole bunch of different demographics and individuals across society how proud, on a scale of pride, how proud they are of being an American. Pretty simple answer. And you could, you know, rate it from extremely proud, moderately proud, just proud, not proud, you know, different scale of pride. The results I thought were really interesting. First takeaway, all adults, 68% extremely proud and 15% moderately proud. So well over 80% of adults were either extremely or moderately proud to be American. It's awesome. Another interesting result I saw or takeaway was that easily more than half of Black and Hispanic sort of poll participants were extremely or very proud to be American. And less than 10% of each group were deemed or designated themselves as not proud. So that was another interesting takeaway. The third one is the one that should concern you and scare you, because this is our future. Young adults, 18 to 24 years old. These are the drones that I just spoke about that are being minted, manufactured by academia across our country. Those young adults, 18 to 24 years old, only 36% extremely or very proud to be American, just barely over a third. Where are they taught to think that way if their parents think differently? Hope you enjoyed this episode of The Far Middle. Back at you soon with episode number 18. Till then, stay safe.